I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. This morning, President Trump suggested in a tweet that Congress should repeal Obamacare now and replace it later. Is that the Senate's next play? The Supreme Court announced that it will hear arguments regarding the president's travel ban. Parts of the ban are now being enforced. This fun fact, grandparents no longer count as close relatives. The AP reports in a new study about redistricting that shows Republicans hold a distinct electoral advantage in many so-called swing states. And then there's Mika Brzezinski. Mr. Trump was tweeting again about her this morning. Will this sorry incident affect the support of the 37% of voters who still support the president? AP White House correspondent Julie Bykowitz and Dr. Carol Anderson of Emory University join me, and we'll have a cappella live in studio by a trio of singers from Zimbabwe. First, the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us for the Midday News Wrap on this sunny Friday afternoon when Senate Republicans unveiled their health care bill a little more than a week ago. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said it would be voted on this week before Congress's July 4th recess. But as I'm sure you know, on Tuesday of this week, McConnell, realizing that he didn't have the 50 votes needed to pass the bill, pulled the plug. So what's next for that bill? According to the Congressional Budget Office, it would result in 22 million people being without health insurance in the next decade. Also this week, the president's travel ban is back in part. The Supreme Court announced that it will hear arguments next fall regarding lower court decisions that stayed the president's executive order and that parts of the president's revised travel ban could be enforced. Companies around the world and the government of Howard County and the office of John Kasich in Ohio had bad incidents of cyber hacking this week. And the AP reports that a new study about redistricting shows that Republicans hold a distinct electoral advantage in many so-called swing states. And then there's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. They visited Trump in Florida the week after Christmas, and yesterday the president gave them a late but fabulous gift when he catapulted them into the center of the ongoing conversation about whether or not the president is mentally ill. Mika and Joe have a very different recollection of their New Year's visits with the Trumps than the president does. The president was tweeting about it again this morning. The morning Joe's staff probably couldn't be more delighted. By the way, that's a guess on my part. No one has reported that. AP White House correspondent Julie Bykowitz reports on a lot, and she joins me for the News Wrap today here in Studio A. And joining us from Atlanta, Dr. Carol Anderson. She's the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University, and the author of the New York Times bestselling book White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Julie, welcome. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Carol, welcome back. It's good to have you as well.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And you are welcome to join us. 410-662-8780 is our number here at the Midday News Wrap. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Julie, I want to start with a story that's been largely overshadowed by all the other silliness going on this week, and that has to do with redistricting. You wrote about this earlier in the week. This is a statistical analysis that the AP commissioned by a group from Princeton University called the Gerrymandering Project. What did they find?
Well, it was actually my colleague David Lieb, and it really is one of the more detailed looks that I've seen about, you know, why it is that our politics keep getting more and more polarized. And it's a very complicated topic, but essentially what you're seeing is a combination of all sorts of factors, including the fact that there's been all kinds of redoing of districts to sort of shape them in ways that benefit one political party or another. And of course, it varies by state. You know, we're very familiar with this here in Maryland. If you take a look at our strange looking map of districts, and you can't help but notice that they make no sense. So, you know, thinking about what the solutions to that are is something that I think we're maybe not paying enough attention to. None of our political leaders seem to be running with this theme, which really sort of goes to the heart of democracy.
And Carol, here in Maryland, the governor proposed a commission to study the districts and to do redistricting, a so-called bipartisan commission. And the legislature overruled him. They said that they want a bill that says we'll do that if the states surrounding Maryland do that as well. So this notion of gerrymandering and stuff, which everybody complains about and nobody seems to do anything about, that's a real this really does have an impact on the body politic, and all of these little, you know, Trump tweet explosions and stuff have to be thought of in the context of that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Here in Georgia, just I think it was last month or so, the Republicans in two districts that the Republicans used to be Republican strongholds, but they barely won in 2016. The legislature then redrew their district boundaries to remove all of basically wide swaths of African Americans out of those districts and cram African Americans then into a Democrat's district and make the other two districts more white. And because the GOP is about 92% white, what looks like it's partisan is also racial. And that's one of the things we cannot forget in this discussion about gerrymandering, and how it leads to disproportionate power then of an increasingly white party that is not going to be in the demographic ascendancy. And so what's happening here is a kind of drilling down, bearing down, holding on for dear life instead of finding ways to work together to benefit everybody in this nation.
And Carol, let me ask you, because you're right there at Emory University in Decatur, Georgia, the home of John Ossoff, which is out of the district he was actually running in against Karen Handel. And a lot of people pointed out that with a $33 million war chest for his campaign, perhaps he could have rented an apartment somewhere in the 6th district. But that's neither here nor there, because that's bygones. However,
just to note, that's not legal. But
yeah,
okay.
Right. Exactly.
But, Technical details.
Well, there's that. Yeah. But Carol, I wonder, I mean, to what extent did race play a factor in that special election?
You know, I think it played a major factor. Karen Handel ran in terms of a very tightly scripted, very conservative, and red, very white agenda. Ossoff, on the other hand, ran more pluralistically, but he was afraid to really get into the fray and deal with what is going on here racially in the United States and in Georgia. And so on one hand, you had the Democrat timidly getting towards it, and you had Handel dog whistling her way all the way through it.
And Julie Bykowitz, speaking of legal, the president held a fundraising event a couple of nights ago, totally by coincidence, at the Trump Hotel down the street from the White House. He raised $10 million. Mm-hmm. You were there. It was barred. The press was barred. I mean, what was the scene there and what happened that night?
Well, the press was barred, so I had no choice but to go to the bar at the hotel. I've been making this case all week. One of the things about President Donald Trump that people like, even people who don't sort of fundamentally like him, appreciate the fact that he is not your typical politician who shapeshifts, changes what he says before each different audience. You see him speaking a certain way in person. You see him speaking the same way in rooms full of donors and the same way at rallies. And I was shocked that the White House and the Republican Party took the step of barring the media from the event, because I think that ultimately hurts that argument that his supporters have that, you know, this guy is different. And of course, as reporters were saying, the audio would probably come out one way or another. And indeed it did. The Intercept was able to, that's a newish investigative website, was able to get 40 minutes of his speech, which I listened to this morning. And it's exactly what I thought. It really could have been the same remarks that he delivered at a rally, the same remarks he delivered in some sort of television interview. In fact, it was so similar to his rallies that he actually exited the fundraiser to the same "you can't always get what you want" music. So it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that that sort of Trump's handlers don't want the public to have that sort of understanding that he isn't going into rooms full of donors and saying something completely different, that he's at all times Donald Trump.
The donors paid $35,000 apiece to be in that ballroom. The government ethics office was, you know, inundated with reminders that the contract for renting mm-hmm. that space, which is the old post office building in Washington, says that government officials can't be party to those contracts. Mm-hmm. So, Carol Anderson, I mean, what are we to make of that? I mean, then all of a sudden, that just goes away. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the Billy Bush tape and the Access Hollywood thing. It's a big kerfuffle, and then it goes away. Things happen with this president that just sort of go away. I mean, Lord knows what we'll be talking about next week. Today, it's Mika Brzezinski and some other stuff. But there is a tendency for stuff to just go away.
And I think that this is part and parcel of a massive change and one that we have to resist. I'm going to put it out there just like that. You had mentioned that, you know, why they like him is that he's not your typical politician. Well, you know, that denigration of a politician, that denigration of someone who has expertise in governing and in government, who knows how to administratively get things done. Somehow that has become a slur, an epithet. But we wouldn't want that for our surgeon. We wouldn't want that for our airline pilot. But somehow we want that for those who have their hands on the reins of government and are moving this nation in one way or another. And so what happens then is that because everything is just chaos, this, you know, Jeb Bush called him the chaos candidate, and now he's the chaos president. And with chaos, there's always something going on. There's always an ethics violation. There's always some slur. There's always some transgression that's happening somewhere, be it going down to his golf courses and marketing those golf courses as, well, the president's here, don't you want to be? So you get profiteering off of the presidency, and we just kind of go, okay, which is what happened during the campaign. And yeah. And it's a slippery slope, and it is a bad slope.
And Julie, I mean, you wrote that the White House insists that they that there's a firewall between the campaign events and government business, that they, you know, do whatever they can to ensure that the political entities pay for campaign mm-hmm. rallies. He's already done, I think, five of them mm-hmm. so far this
right.
year. He's only been in office, you know, he's less than 6 months or something, mm-hmm. or just about 6 months. What's your level of belief in that claim that, in fact, these things are at least being financially separated?
Well, the good news is that we will have documentation at some point of some of these issues. Since he's a registered candidate, he's got his campaign committee and through the Republican Party as well, we will be able to see if and when the White House is doing what it says in terms of reimbursing for certain spaces, for certain government functions that have to be, you know, with him at all times, the security, Air Force One, and so forth. So we'll all be paying very close attention to his Federal Election Commission filings and, you know, get a sense of whether those payments are coming through. It's very early, so, you know, these things take months to invoice and so forth. But that's, I guess you could view that as a positive aspect of him just, you know, jumping in and becoming a candidate so soon.
But there is no doubt that by holding this event at the Trump Hotel, they get paid for the food, they get paid for the bar, including whatever you drank at the bar mm-hmm. that night yourself, they get paid for the rental of the space. I mean, anybody who's ever booked a convention or mm-hmm. booked a conference or a gala knows that these are expensive things. The Trump company profited from that event. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no doubt about that, right?
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. And this was really previewed because he sort of took the same approach while he was a candidate. So again, it's one of those things that you just wonder, were people paying attention during the election? What, you know, this was all sort of the same pattern of behavior throughout the 2016 campaign. It's not like he's sort of become something new and different versus when he was a candidate. And their argument, which I think, you know, holds some water, is that voters knew all these things and they elected him president.
Disruption is what they wanted, and boy, oh boy, they got it. We're going to take a little break. We are going to disrupt this conversation for just about 90 seconds. AP White House correspondent Julie Bykowitz is here with me in Studio A. Dr. Carol Anderson is on the line from Emory University. She's the chair of the African American Studies Department at that prestigious university, and she's the author, most recently, of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. You can join us when we come back, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up Monday on the broadcast, we're going to re-air one of our favorite recent programs. It's a look at internet privacy. We'll have a philosopher, a legal scholar, and a cybersecurity expert to weigh in on internet privacy. So I hope you can join us Monday here on Midday. And coming up a little later this afternoon, we're going to hear from a terrific a cappella group from Zimbabwe. They're called Inzingisi, and they will be here in studio singing for us. If you are just joining us today, as I said, it's the Midday News Wrap. AP White House correspondent Julie Bykowitz joins me here in Studio A, and Dr. Carol Anderson is on the line from Emory University, where she chairs the African American Studies Department. She's the author of the best-selling book White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We had a wonderful conversation about that when I was hosting the morning show. I recommend that book heartily. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayTomHall. I want to listen to an ad that the NRA posted on Facebook this week, in the context of the fact that President Trump really has now, in these first 6 months, to my reckoning at least, made no effort whatsoever to reach across the aisle, to reach out to anybody who didn't vote for him. NPR, PBS NewsHour, Marist poll this week asked adults across the country, do you approve or disapprove of the job Mr. Trump is doing as president? And just 37% of Americans approve, 51% disapprove, and 40% of those who polled strongly disapprove of Mr. Trump's performance. That's twice as much as the 20% who strongly approved. But again, with these rallies and stuff, the president is playing to, you know, he's singing, he's preaching to the choir, as they say. He's appearing in front of people who are inclined to support him. And then there's this. This is an ad that the NRA posted on Facebook.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
So, Carol Anderson, the clenched fist of truth. I mean, this in the era of fake news, in the era of,
oh,
you know,
God,
the media being the enemy of the people, mm-hmm. I mean, that comes awfully close to calling for armed insurrection.
Yes, it does. And it is beautiful propaganda. particularly part of what we have to realize is that just the way that Trump only talks to those who are in his choir, and that the news that they get comes from basically the choir chamber. This NRA ad was directed right there as well, so that the litany of lies that have emanated out of the White House are easily dismissed. The facts, the massive, wonderful investigative reporting that is happening in our free press is quickly dismissed as fake news. Critical thinking that's in our schools that allow our children to be able to discern truth from fiction then becomes indoctrination. I mean, so it crafts this dystopian world of us against them, and that the only thing that can protect is not our belief in democracy, not our belief in our incredible civic institutions and our civil society and our quest for democracy, but instead is this clenched fifth. And given that these are the Second Amendment folks, we know what that means. And so it immediately then wipes away that the violence that has been raining down on marginalized people in the United States. And it's basically saying they don't have a right to protest. They don't have a First Amendment right. That is scary, dictatorially scary.
Yeah, and Julie Bykowitz, I mean, it's not as if the left doesn't also resort to things that are very inappropriate and very uncivil. I mean, when Kathy Griffin, as a comedian, stands there with an image of a beheaded Donald Trump as if he's John the Baptist or something, it's terrible. And the level of discourse here, I mean, you're writing for the AP. You and your colleagues at the AP write stories that are read by millions of people, because it's not just here in the United States, mm-hmm. but people pick up the feed from AP across the globe. Mm-hmm. And you're writing for everybody. You know, you're writing for the globe. And here we have a president and people who, and organizations who support him, talking to this segment of the population.
Sure. Well, on this specific advertising effort by the NRA, it actually answers a question that I've had for a few months now, which is, what is the NRA going to do to keep raising money? They were extremely successful, raised record amounts of money under President Obama because they had an extremely easy message, which was, Obama is here to take your guns. I've been thinking since the election, now that that argument, which translates into hundreds of millions of dollars, is off the table, what in the world is their message going to be? And this seems to me to be sort of their new effort to keep the financial tides flowing towards them. And it's really unfortunate because it's just difficult to listen to that video and feel comfortable. It's just very charged language, very targeted towards a specific group of people that already think a certain way. And it comes on the heels of all sorts of violent incidents, including someone shooting at members of Congress recently. It's just it's scary in a lot of different ways for democracy.
And then, of course, we had the situation in the press briefing room at the White House, where you spend a lot of time. Between Brian Karam and Assistant Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Let's listen to that exchange that happened earlier this week.
News outlets get to go on day after day and cite unnamed sources, use stories without sources, have, you know, you mentioned the Scaramucci story where they had to have reporters resign.
Come on. You're inflaming everybody right here and right now with those words. This administration has done that as well. Why in the name of heavens? Any one of us, right, are replaceable. And any one of us, if we don't get it right, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us.
I think
have been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions.
Right.
We're here to provide the answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everybody else out here is fake media. And everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
So, Carol Anderson, when we talk about resistance, what is the proper response when things like, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders was referring to a CNN.com report that was retracted. It was a single-sourced, anonymous source thing that implied, you know, more connections between the Trump organization, Trump campaign, and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Three of the journalists involved in that, Lex Harris and Eric Lichtblau and Thomas Frank. And Eric Lichtblau, you know, is a Pulitzer Prize winning former correspondent for the New York Times, a highly respected guy. What is the right response when the media gets it wrong, which happens all the time? And, you know, retractions are made, apologies are made, corrections are made. But other than that, is there something that, that the people on the other side of Mr. Trump's political philosophy can and should do?
You know, the media does what it's supposed to do. When you have a story that has not been properly sourced, has not met the journalistic standards, then you investigate, figure out how that happened, and there are consequences. The problem is that CNN this time stood up and said, ah, this is not who we are. This is not what we do. Yet we have had right-wing media go out on stories like the, I believe it's the Seth Rich story that Sean Hannity was just trumpeting over and over again, or the Pizzagate thing. And when those things blow up, there are no consequences. And so you get this sense of then when mainstream journalism, in fact, follows journalistic standards, that somehow that's a na-na-na-na-na-na, when in fact that's what's supposed to happen. And that's what I mean about this erosion in our norms, this shifting tide, this moving into this kind of Kafkaesque Alice in Wonderland world where right is wrong and wrong is left and up is down. And so we don't have our moorings anymore.
And Julie Baikowitz, I wonder what the mood is like in the White House briefing room these days. I mean, there's controversy about whether or not the briefings will be made on tape or not, whether they're videotape or the audio only. We have this, you know, L'Affaire Brzezinski, when I'm going to assume that our listeners know about the president's tweets and, you know, the accusations that she was bleeding from, you know, cosmetic surgery, et cetera, et cetera. I'm reminded of this book that Mark Leibovich from The Times wrote about 4 years ago called This Town, and this very uncomfortable coziness between people in the media and people that they're covering. So I had a question as to why Mr. Scarborough and Ms. Brzezinski were at Mar-a-Lago anyway. You know, is this just a bunch of rich New Yorkers still hanging out because they've known each other for a long time? And how that clouds this whole thing? And whether you think that this particular incident, which people, even Republican congressmen and women and senators are saying, this is over the top and inappropriate and unbecoming of the President of the United States. Is that going to, what's it going to be like, you know, Monday when everybody goes to work in the White House again?
Well, it's a very tense time in the White House for everyone, not only for the media that cover the White House, but for the staff members at the White House, too, the people who have to, you know, constantly explain or at least be fielding questions about the president's tweets and things that have nothing to do with policy and that, you know, most professional government employees want nothing to do with, but still have to sort of get out there and either defend or deflect anyway. The scenes described in This Town of coziness and the Mika and Joe visiting Mar-a-Lago, you know, that's one extreme. And then I would argue we're sort of quickly, if we're not already there, swinging towards this other extreme, which is that there's no relationship. I mean, to do our jobs, there has to be a level of respect and trust. It is a balancing act. You don't want to tip too far one way and you don't want to tip too far the other way. I feel like we're going from one extreme perhaps to the other, and it is troubling. We never in the media, particularly at AP, we never like to be the story. We don't want to be writing about press relations. I can't imagine that the public finds that terribly interesting in light of all the other stuff going on. At the same time, you know, we don't want people to lose sight of the fact that you know, the media is in many ways the eyes and ears of the public. And, you know, as we lose access, so does the rest of the country.
Julie Bykowitz is White House reporter for the AP. Carol Anderson is on the faculty of Emory University. It's the News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. 410-662-8780 is our number. Our email, midday@wipr.org, if you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Carol Anderson, I wonder, is it possible that with so many of these controversies, and, you know, when the President of the United States acts in such a brutish and inappropriate way, is everybody, supporters and opponents alike, becoming inured to it? I mean, does it simply happen so often that people are just going to stop paying attention to it?
You know, it's, to me, it feels like part of a strategy is that you just keep throwing so much garbage out there that it's really hard to pay attention. And I've heard so many people say that they're just exhausted. Just exhausted.
I would second that. Yeah. I am personally exhausted.
I bet you are. I'm exhausted just reading what you're writing, Julie, and I can imagine how exhausting it must be to write it.
Oh my gosh! Right, and the problem is that as exhausted as we are, if we don't stay on this, if we don't understand that strong journalism, that truth, that the right to vote are absolutely essential in this democracy, then we have lost this democracy. What does it say? The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. And so, yeah, there is this exhaustion. There is this tiredness. There is so much that is coming at us that it makes it hard to focus. So, for instance, we're talking about Mika and Joe, but we have dangling over us right now a health care bill where 15 million could lose their insurance next year alone if it goes through.
Yeah, when it comes to policy, Julie, I mean, none of this is helping policy. I mean, how is Senator Collins, you know, Senator Murkowski, Senator Capito, how are they supposed to rally themselves around a health care bill for a president who is saying things like this about yet another woman? I mean, it's just, it's awful. And when it comes to that, and Carol's notion that this is somehow, you know, throwing all this silliness out there is a strategy for distraction. When it comes to strategy, it seems like the worst strategy ever. I mean, politically, I mean, if he really is interested in getting a bill passed, first he's calling the House version mean, and then he's, you know, so. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of concern on the part of Senator McConnell, for example, that a Trump super PAC, America First Policies, is now running ads against Republican senators.
Sure.
I mean, the senator from Nevada.
Sure. Right. This is actually a nonprofit, not a super PAC, which is an important distinction because we may never know who the donors are who are underwriting this effort. And I think that is it a political strategy? It's tough to say, but you can at this point conclude that it's not helping Republicans in general, because we have not heard Republicans go out there and make their case in a strong way for either of these health care bills. And I wonder, is it because they don't have a strong case to make, or is it because there's so much else in the ether being discussed, like Mika tweets? The people who really believe in these bills, the Senate bill and the House bill, are they frustrated that they can't get more of a megaphone with a president this dominant? I don't know.
Yeah. Wall Street Journal had an editorial a few days ago in support of the Senate bill. And they say, quote, repairing the failing individual insurance market, putting Medicaid on a budget for the first time in the entitlement's history, and passing an enormous pro-growth tax cut are historic opportunities.
Well,
so that's what they're coming up with as the raison d'être for the bill.
That's a fair point for Republicans to be making. Why are they not making it? And part of the reason why is because of all of these other discussions that are going on that have nothing to do with policy, nothing to do with healthcare.
Carol Anderson, I want to talk a little bit about an op-ed that I noticed by Sally Yates, the erstwhile assistant or deputy attorney general, who wrote about Jeff Sessions, the current attorney general's inclination to take crime and law enforcement back 20 or 30 years. And she notes that people as you know, disparate politically as Senator Cornyn from Texas, the Koch brothers, Senator Leahy from Connecticut, the ACLU are behind efforts to get rid of mandatory minimum drug sentences. They call them counterproductive. Yet Jeff Sessions is doubling down and suggesting that that should be the way forward. What do you make of that?
I think that the relaunch of the war on drugs, I think the best way to frame this is, remember when Trump talked about during the campaign black people living in hell holes and all of this crime, yada, 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 and there was the way to do it. It's because they, and somebody described it as he got stuck in 1980s New York City. And his vision hasn't moved beyond that moment. I would say the same with Jeff Sessions. He is stuck in somewhere between 1850 and 1950. And what we know about the war on drugs is that it was targeted. It was targeted towards African Americans and it was targeted toward Hispanics. We know that because we have the research data that show that, for instance, black people use drugs basically the least, or in some cases for some drugs at the same amount as other races and ethnicities. Yet they are jailed at 10 times the rate. So for doing it the least or at the same amount, jailed 10 times the rate. We have had state budgets absolutely destabilized via mass incarceration. This is, we're not investing in our people. We're, in fact, warehousing them because then we strip them of all of their rights that allow them to be able to function if and when they get out as citizens. This is a failed policy, but this is one that he is picking up and holding up because they have this vision where they talk about, you know, crime is at an all-time high. Yeah. When
it's not.
It's not.
Yeah. And of course, Julie, and I'm going to give you the last word here because we're running out of time. We have a caller who we're not going to be able to take. I apologize, but he asked the question, you know, why doesn't the press call out the administration when they lie? And of course, I think we could all point to many instances in which that very thing happens. I want to ask very quickly about the travel ban, which they call a Supreme Court decision. It wasn't really a decision. It's an unsigned thing that says they're going to take it up in October. And they did allow certain aspects of the executive order to go into place. The White House is counting this as a win. How do you think that that accords with reality?
Well, it's a significantly narrower plan than the president originally wanted, which he has not been shy about saying that, you know, he didn't want to do this sort of narrowed down plan in the first place, that he liked his original ban that was quickly dismissed as not okay. So it's going to be interesting seeing what happens in October. And until then, lots of, you know, I'm surprised that we're not hearing a little bit more from the White House about this. I mean, they did count it as a win, but then it sort of quickly went away into the flames of everything else this week.
Well, Julie Beichwitz, I really appreciate your being here, and I understand you're on vacation, my friend, and you
yes.
came in anyway, and so double kudos to you.
Thank you
so much. And Carol Anderson, I don't know if you're on vacation or not. As an academic, you get the whole summer off, or are you working it for a living today?
Oh, that is cruel and wrong. We work 49 days a week.
That's right. That's what I hear. All right. Sorry. I'm incredibly jealous. All right. I appreciate both of you guys being on with us today. Dr. Carol Anderson from Emory University and AP White House correspondent Julie Beichwitz. When we return after a break, Nsingizi is going to join me in the studio. They're a terrific a cappella group from Zimbabwe. They're singing this weekend at Patterson Park, and they'll give us a preview in just 90 seconds. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.